You're listening to A Climate Affair. I'm Kate Conroy with you this afternoon, and welcome to the show. How's your week been, and what is the week doing in the world of the environment? We've got a great show today. I've got a couple of interviews. One, we're talking to Stephen Gale. This is a Melbourne man who's going to be riding his bicycle from Melbourne to Sydney to show just how easy it is. And he's going to be very interesting. He's an engineer. He works on solar energy. He's invented all sorts of mechanisms to make people's lives easier. And he has his own personal mandate to change the world that we live in, to live a cleaner, more renewable lifestyle. So he'll be with us in about an hour's time. And then we're going to be talking with Glenn Walker from the Wilderness Society. And he's going to talk to us about wild rivers in Queensland. And that's going to be at 6 o'clock this evening. His discussion will cover issues that are pertinent to political problems right now regarding water in Queensland. Should we divert the great wild rivers of Queensland through New South Wales, Victoria, and ultimately pop them into South Australia and fill up lake air full of water so that we get more evaporative water in the centre of Australia and then it falls as rainfall to make the centre of Australia more fertile? That's the Bradfield scheme, which the Premier Peter Beattie has been touting during the last week or so as a solution to Australia's water problems. Planet Radio 88 FM. I'm Kate Conroy with you this afternoon. So this week were the Oscars. There was a lot of excitement as various people got out in their fancy dress, and a lot of films got awards, including our own Happy Feet, the Australian movie, well, made by a lot of Australians, involving a lot of Australians, which is terrific. But one of the interesting aspects of the Academy Awards this year was its green element. So, for example, the double Oscar win for An Inconvenient Truth, not for A Climate Affair. I'll win next year, of course. But this year, An Inconvenient Truth, written by former Vice President Al Gore, and includes inside that movie an expanded slideshow on global warming. It looks like the winning of that documentary could spur grassroots support for the fight against climate change. And that's because a movie, especially one that many Americans have seen on home video, takes the issue beyond the realm of distant policymakers and puts it on a more personal footing. And the funny thing about the Oscars is they're very intimate. People watch them in their living rooms. And so global warming has seemed, you know, may have seemed abstract or distant, something for people who are experts and know more than the person at home. But what the Oscar victory does for Gore and for the environmental movement is puts the issue of climate change and global warming into people's living rooms. And it's true that the climatology is very complicated. They're going to see that the solutions are pretty commonsensical. And hopefully people will talk about them and get excited about them. Inconvenient Truth won 2 Academy Awards on Sunday, one for Best Documentary and the other for Best Song, which I think is great. And I think Melissa Etheridge wrote that song as well. So there's a bit of a queer victory as well as a green victory. Lots of E's in queer and green. Must be good. And so in another related boost for the environmental movement, Gore appeared with the actor Leonardo DiCaprio, who announced that this year's televised ceremony had actually gone green. What does that mean? Well, the telecast producers did arrange for hybrid vehicles for presenters and staff, comprehensive recycling for the event, and the purchase of renewable energy credits to offset greenhouse gas emissions during the event. I think this is really impressive, because if there's one area that I see as being particularly obsessed with image, and that's Hollywood and celebrity. And people are sort of addicted to it in the same way that royalty, people would look at royalty and think, wow, that's the good life. That's the life where I don't have to care about money, or I don't have to worry about who's going to make my sandwich this morning. I'll just call Fred the butler and he'll come upstairs and he'll whip me up some cucumber sandwiches. It's a life that we look at and we think, gosh, if only I had what they had. If only I was that beautiful. If only I was that skinny. If only I was that rich. I couldn't be so burdened with my problems. Now, of course, that's a load of rubbish, and doesn't matter how much money you've got, you're going to be burdened with problems, as we all experience all the time. Money may buy your marble bathroom, but it doesn't clean the vomit off the sink when your child throws up. So there's problems that everyone has to face, and the celebrities have them as well. Nevertheless, the industry capitalizes on this image of opulence and wealth and material success. And the Academy Awards, in my mind, are particularly focused on aesthetic qualities, superficial qualities, like the kind of dress that celebrities are wearing, the jewellery that they're wearing. If you saw the Australian telecast of the Academy Awards, you saw Wilkins interview someone and he asked how much money was the necklace around her neck worth, and he sort of made a humor comment about it could, you know, feed a nation for a week or something like that. It was sort of embarrassing for the star, because of course it's a bit embarrassing to be wearing such an enormous piece of jewellery. So in this sort of context where people are spending $20,000 on a dress and the size of your jewels are what gets commented on, the addition of the green educational element I think is going to have a really big effect. And I think what we're getting at here is with things like Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth being part of the Academy Awards and Leonardo DiCaprio saying we're going green and that's what we're aiming to do from here on out, will have far greater impact than a lot of musty old scientists sitting around in universities somewhere. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM on a hot and humid afternoon in beautiful Brisbane in Australia this afternoon. I'm Kate Conroy with you, and we're talking about the greening of the Academy Awards. What's interesting about the Academy Award greening effect is even the Governor's Ball, which is the big gala ceremony, big gala after the ceremony, featured organic and environmentally friendly food, including a large chocolate Oscar, which I'm not sure why that's environmentally friendly. I suppose the chocolate was organic. Let's hope it was also ethically produced cocoa. It's really exciting to see such a depth of commitment from these guys. And I think it's happened fairly quickly. I think within a couple of years, the Oscars have realized that they are a huge influence in American culture, and they've taken that role on very seriously. Whether you like it or hate it, education is coming from different areas than the ones that our parents or our grandparents got their information from. So it's very good. So the other thing is, it's interesting to think what might happen because An Inconvenient Truth has won an Academy Award. Will it actually raise awareness of the issue with ordinary people? And if that happens, could it have a big bearing on actual policy shifts? Because it's interesting how many times people have been in senators' or congresspeople's offices before this time, and they say that they've never been contacted by people in their area, constituents, who were concerned by global warming or climate change. Whereas the movie and the press about the movie are all helping to make people understand the issue. And perhaps legislators are going to start to hear much more from their constituents regarding concern for the environment. And what's really funny, of course, is that Al Gore, during the stage presence at the Academy Awards, he got a few laughs by making humorous veiled allusions to a possible White House bid prompted by Leonardo DiCaprio. Now, Al Gore has never categorically ruled out a 2008 run for the presidency, but he says he's concentrating on his climate change campaign. The political mood is changed enough in recent years that US governors, most notably California's Arnold Schwarzenegger, is, you know, a former movie star, we know that, and he even accepts that acting to cut emissions of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide can help a politician's career. So it's a big change in American politics, and it looks like it's becoming not an issue just for the Democrats anymore. That's, I think, one of the most exciting things. And as a friend of mine noted, one of the important things about Al Gore not running for presidency is that it actually prevents the issue of the environment becoming a partisan issue. It prevents the environment becoming a Democrat platform. If Al Gore just remains an educator of all people and a helper of everyone, then all politicians can say, oh yeah, I am a Republican, I am a conservative, and yeah, I saw that movie, An Inconvenient Truth, and yeah, I thought they had some good things to say. And if American car companies are making much less profits than cars which are making hybrid vehicles or efficient vehicles like Hyundai, Toyota, Honda, those are the companies producing the most profit, and they're also producing the most environmentally sensitive vehicles. Gosh, well, I believe in economics. I'm a Republican. I'm all about it. Capitalism. Why aren't American companies becoming greener? So there's an easy way for these politicians within the framework of their current political beliefs to incorporate environmentalism, as so long as it actually is an issue that isn't one that's dominated by political agenda issues such as getting into office. So some of us might think, oh, if only Al Gore did run for president, I think he would be fantastic. keep in mind that perhaps it's really good to have him doing exactly what he's doing right now. A big issue for Australians has been the bushfires that have ravaged southeastern Australia. One of the ways to deal with this is to look at the Aboriginal solutions to fire in the ancient environment of Australia, because they may hold the key to battling huge bushfires, the mega bushfires, which have blackened large parts not only of Australia, but of Europe and the United States in recent years. So the prehistoric Indigenous people of our country across Australia methodically burnt land to hunt and stimulate the growth of plants, as well as to reduce the fierceness of natural bushfires. They also understood that forest fuels could not go untended. In an early lesson for modern societies threatened by megafires triggered by climate change and rising world temperatures, the Indigenous Australians weren't traditional agriculturalists in the way that Western people go and settle in one place and then grow crops routinely over the same patch of land. But that doesn't mean that they weren't manipulators of their environment. They weren't simple hunter-gatherers. They weren't primitive people who didn't understand the land that they were working with. They had a very good understanding of the land, and from that understanding came an ability to recognize how to manage our very oily wood that comes from eucalyptus, and how to flush out wildlife, how to regenerate vegetation, and how to keep a certain balance between the animals and humans and the environment that they were a part of. There was a focus on what was sustainable rather than attachment to land in the same way that Westerners have been attached to the land today. So I've thought about this for a long time, but it's interesting that now it's getting, I suppose, news coverage as opposed to just being a story or something from a science museum or something like that. But yes, so there was a big meeting about this in Canberra, and they're trying to figure out why, you know, what we're reserving our forests for. So when Australia leaves big tracts of forests to just grow, well, what are we doing that for? And it looks like some of what we're doing it for is to contribute to these really huge fires, these megafires. And megafires occur when large bushfires merge and form super fire fronts that burn with hurricane intensity, often leveling hundreds of homes and vast areas of bushland. Megafires in 2003 destroyed thousands of homes in France, Portugal, Spain, the US and Canada, while fires this year swept uncontrolled for more than a month through an area bigger than Lebanon in Australia's rugged southeastern Alps, as we know here in Australia. Top fire expert from the US has told the meeting of scientists in Canberra that a recent megafires were the result of political and environmental decisions globally to curtail forest burn-offs. With the US bill for fighting fires already topping $400 million a year, the cost of megafire suppression would only grow with global warming unless laws favouring environmental protection rather than deliberate burn-offs were reviewed. He says we need to take more risk in using fire. Climate experts told the conference that steady global temperature rises were leading to longer fire seasons across the world, and megafires burned with such intensity that they left little behind. There is no refuge for fauna, and our choice is whether we burn frequently at low intensity in mild weather of our choosing, or whether we are subjected to the whims of nature. The controlling of our forests is such an interesting issue, and it's something which is dealt with in Jared Diamond's book Collapse, which is dealing with how societies of the past have collapsed, perhaps due to the lack of understanding of their environment, and how those lessons might be applied to help us today in our difficult environmental times. And he talks about fires, the forestry in the US, and the ability after World War II of the US to protect much greater proportions of their forests because of the ability of firefighters to use planes and advanced technology to put them out as soon as they started. And what happened was that the natural forest cycle got disrupted because of this, and instead of there being a thin, multi-layered growth in the forest where the big old trees survived small fires, and animals were able to hide around those small those big trees, the protection of the forests from fires meant that they got these much bigger, more intense fires that destroyed everything, including these older trees. And so when the forest actually grew back, you had a lot of thin growth, and that also grew for the next generation to make terrible hot fires as well. So it's fascinating to see how the good intention to protect the forests has actually had somewhat of a negative effect in the development of these huge fires, which have so decimated our surroundings. Obviously, we've got a lot to learn on that front. Planet Radio 88 FM. This is Kate Conroy, and you're listening to A Climate Affair. So do you buy eggs? Most of us do buy eggs, and most of us think that there's a reason we should be picking the eggs that we eat. And perhaps free-range eggs are the way to go, and perhaps there's something really bad about battery eggs. But do you really understand the labels? I mean, sometimes it's really difficult to know the difference between the various things that we see on the supermarket shelves. And The Age actually has a really nice breakdown of what the kindest eggs in the supermarket are. So here's what the different categories really mean for you and the chicken. So if you see something called vegetarian eggs, that means they're laid not by free-range hens, but birds confined to cages or barns. These birds eat a vegetarian diet, meaning it contains no ingredients from animals or fish. Free-range birds aren't vegetarians. When chickens forage outside, they do what chickens naturally do, eat insects and grubs. And in case you're wondering, a vegetarian egg has the same levels of fat, cholesterol, and protein as other eggs. So cage eggs. Well, although we're buying fewer cage eggs, about 73% of eggs sold in supermarkets and shops come from caged hens living in sheds. From next year, cage hens will have slightly larger cages in which to spend the 70-odd weeks of their lives. That's interesting, 70-odd weeks. That's only just over a year, and I'm sure hens can live much more than that. I wonder why they die so soon. Nevertheless, the size of the new cages, housing three or four hens at a time, will give each bird at least 550 square centimetres. Well, it's better than the previous minimum standard of 450 square centimetres, but it still means a caged chicken's personal space is slightly smaller than a piece of A4 paper. That's for its entire life. That's pretty minimal. There's not much you can do in that space, and certainly doesn't allow the chickens any real flexibility in their day. Free-range eggs. Well, this is the kindest choice. Chickens under that that classification are free to roam on open ground every day. Free-range egg sales have now increased to 22% of retail options. But how do you know eggs labelled free-range are really free-range? There are actually a number of free-range associations in different states offering certification to farmers producing free-range eggs. Certification is voluntary, not compulsory, according to the Australian Egg Corporation. You can look at that at www.eggs.org.au. And about 70% of farms producing free-range eggs are certified. Free-range eggs from a certified farm should carry a logo with the words Certified Free-Range Farm with the name of the certifying organisation. And you can check it out by going to the New South Department of Primary Industry website, which is www.agric.newsouthwales.gov.au. And I think you should probably just put in poultry or free-range eggs as a search term, because the actual internet URL is so long, we'd be here all afternoon. Barn-laid eggs. Well, hens living indoors but have room to stretch, socialise, perch and move around. Even though free-range probably gives chickens a better lifestyle, living in a barn with nest boxes and litter to peck around certainly beats life in a cage and is the next best option for the chicken. So that means we're looking at free-range eggs, barn-laid eggs, and then cage eggs. However, although there's also organic eggs. Although not all free-range eggs are organic, all organic eggs must be free-range. I didn't know that. Did not know that organic eggs had to be coming from free-range chickens and from hens eating feed that's 95% organically grown grain. Organic eggs must carry the label of one of the seven organisations in Australia that certify organic food. And then we've got the final category, omega-3 eggs. They can be from cage, free-range or barn-laid eggs, and fish oil goes into their feed so their eggs contain more omega-3 fats. So in terms of animal welfare, free-range, organic or barn-laid are the best bet at the supermarket. But if you're on a budget, it's not always easy to pass up cage eggs, which can be half the price of free range or barn eggs. But the next time you're trying to decide what comes first, the hen or your hip pocket, consider that even at $5.50 or $6, they're a good source of protein and they get great nutrients. This is A Climate Affair. I'm Kate Conroy. And I've got a special guest in the studio. Well, not in the studio, on the phone, actually, down in Melbourne, Stephen Gale. Stephen, are you with us?
Certainly am, Kate.
Wow, I can hear you coming through. That's terrific. So, Stephen, I hear that you're about to embark on a very interesting adventure from Melbourne. Why don't you tell us all about it?
I sure am. I'm heading with a team of my newfound friends on electric bicycles from Melbourne to Sydney. And we're going to ride via the coastal route. The catch is, however, we're wearing our respective corporate attire. I'll wear a business suit, which isn't exactly something I wear a whole lot of, but it seems appropriate. But there's going to be people wearing things like scientists in lab coats and a photographer in his photographer outfit, those jackets with all the pockets, and a lawyer, a rock star, all kinds of people. And what we're trying to demonstrate is the fact that these electric bicycles really are a pretty good way of getting around, and are a good alternative to dragging a ton of metal around with you when really you didn't need to go all that far in the first place.
It sounds absolutely fascinating. Could you tell us a little bit more about the concept of the electric bike for my listeners?
An electric bike's a very simple thing, actually. All it really is an ordinary bicycle with a battery and an electric motor added. The motor doesn't do everything for you. It's not like a motorbike, but it makes a hell of a difference compared to pedalling off your own steam. So when it comes to going up hills and even just coasting along at a reasonable speed, the motor's doing a lot of the work for you. The big thing about them is they're not a motorcycle, so they don't need to be registered, and they can just be ridden on bike paths, and if you're under 12 on the footpath or whatever. But the big plus is they don't use fuel.
They don't use fuel. So how does that work? How does the electricity get into the motor?
Okay, I didn't speak that exactly perfectly. They do need to be recharged. But in realistic terms, the amount of power that we're talking about is probably the order of 100th per kilometre of a car.
Wow.
So our conversion efficiency is very, very high. So in real terms, we're using close to nothing compared to getting around in even a pretty good car.
So let me get this right. So I've got my electric bike and I plug it in at home in an ordinary socket?
That's right.
Wow. How long does the battery last for?
It depends on whether you're going up hills, how big you are and all those sorts of things. But as a rule of thumb, if you're going along straight roads without hills, you're looking at about 35 kilometres worth.
Okay.
That's quite a reasonable distance, and you can take the charger with you and charge it up at the other end if you need to go a whole lot further than that, or if you're round trips further than that. But that's the sort of distance, actually a lot more than most people travel in a car every day.
Amazing. So how much do they cost, these electric bikes?
In Australia at the moment, they are relatively expensive things, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do this. It seemed to me that the price that I paid was somewhere in the order of $1,800, which was, I thought, a lot. What I hoped would happen was that someone would jump on this and say, we can get the parts in at a much lower price. Why don't we do that? And that's precisely what's happened. A company here in Melbourne has been established, and they're going to be importing these bikes, which we're going to use on the trip, selling for around about $1,000, and that's a complete bike.
Wow. I mean, some people spend that much money on an ordinary mountain bike these days easily.
When you consider that the average person, according to the RMA, in RMA, spends $12,000 per annum on their car, $1,000 really isn't too bad.
So what's your purpose in doing this ride for people? What do you want them to know about it?
When I bought the electric bike, the first thing that struck me was that no one seemed to know about these things, and it seemed like such an obvious means of getting around compared to driving in a car, which obviously uses a lot of fuel and makes a lot of emission. These things basically emit almost nothing when you even taking into account the power needed to charge up the battery. So it seemed like a way that we could reduce our overall emissions quite a bit if many people took them up.
It certainly seems the case, and I have to say, on my second show, I actually interviewed a business owner, Wildilocks, over in Western Australia, and I asked her what she was most excited about environmentally, and she actually mentioned electric bikes as her most exciting, you know, sort of introduction of a change in her lifestyle. She's just an ordinary person, and she has now got an electric bike, and she cannot rave on enough about how wonderful it is.
It's pretty easy to be a bit of an evangelist about these sorts of things. I have to watch myself at parties and things like that, that I don't bore everyone to tears with these sorts of stories. But
absolutely.
I don't use my car very much at all.
Right.
It's a nice car, but I simply don't need it most of the time.
And Australians have such a terrific environment in terms of bicycle riding. We don't suffer from snow. We don't have terrible freezing winds. We've barely got any rain, which is pretty good actually for cycling, because that's some of the reasons I think people in America avoid taking on cycling, is the climate problems in the areas they live.
Strangely enough, it used to be a bit of an issue in Melbourne. It's not so much anymore. We don't seem to get a lot of rain these days.
No. So maybe making the best of a bad situation there, getting more people on their bikes.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So you originally planned this just for yourself. You were going to do this ride. Tell me about the development of your idea and how you got other people to join you.
When it was just me, it seemed like a pretty easy thing. I thought, well, this is simple enough. I'll just get a bike, and I'll just get a pile of spare batteries, and I'll go and do it. The thing that did occur to me was largely from some feedback from other people. Joe Camilleri heard about this.
You mean the guitar player?
That's the one. His comment was, well, it sounds like a guy that's got a lot to do with his time. And that was a fair comment, I think. If it's one person doing a ride like this, it really does seem like a bit of an eccentric guy doing some solitary ride. If I can convince 20 people, which is just I'm at 12 now, and looking for 8 more, which I might talk to you about in a moment.
Yeah.
By having a decent number of people, all from different walks of life, then suddenly it's not about me anymore. It's really a demonstration of this is something just about anybody can do. And I thought that would bring home the message much stronger.
That's right, the message being you don't have to be you don't have to be an eccentric, greeny, hippie sort of person to think that this is a reasonable thing to do.
That's right, it really is for ordinary people. That was the whole suit idea, and the idea of the name Suitable Transport in the first place.
Suitable Transport, very, very catchy, that one. Good on the puns. So tell me, some of the infrastructure or the pragmatic constraints of organising this trip. I mean, how long is it going to take? When are you leaving? What sorts of factors do you have to think about for such a thing?
Okay, well, 16th of April is the date when I depart from Melbourne, and there's a big launch for that. The band Bomber, who pretty much pack out the place down here, are going to be playing at the launch, and they usually attract a pretty decent crowd. Now, then we've got about 1,000 kilometres to travel. The things go roughly about 25 to 30 kilometres an hour on level ground, but when we face hills and things, obviously we're going to slow down. When we're going down hills, we'll speed up a little bit. What I've had to do was try and figure out where we'd need to be changing batteries. And we're going to take additional batteries along. Some friends of mine needed their car bought from Sydney to Melbourne. So a couple of days ago, I travelled to Sydney and drove the car to Melbourne with an altimeter sitting on the dash of the thing. And I recorded every hill. So
wow.
I've got a unique record of the Princess Highway altitude and distance-wise. And from that, I can work out about where the batteries will go flat and have a little man sitting there with a pile of spares, and we'll just swap them over and keep on doing the next bit.
That's amazing. So how long in total do you think it's going to take?
Precisely 8 days.
8 days.
Yep. We'll be leaving on the 16th of April, and we'll be rolling up into Sydney. I'd thought in the morning, but I've just done my sums. It looks like it's going to be Sydney afternoon, about 3 o'clock or so, we should arrive probably at the Botanic Gardens.
And I'm going to remind everyone that you're going through the Coast Road, aren't you? You're not going up the Hume Highway.
That's right. It's vastly, vastly a prettier road, I feel, and the scenic possibilities there are just fantastic. The beaches are gorgeous, the towns are really lovely, so it will be quite a spectacular ride.
Have you contacted the councils or the towns that you'll be going through so that you can get some community support as you ride on?
I certainly have, and there's a few local radio stations for those places. In fact, as I discovered, they're the only local radio stations. They don't actually get anything else. So, sure, we'll be in touch with them, and hopefully some of the locals might like to pedal for a little bit of the way with us.
Oh, sounds great. I'm sure the kids will jump in. They always love that stuff. I mean, think of the Tour de France in Europe. Maybe this could become something more regular than just the one-off.
At this moment in my life, as I'm contemplating the realities of getting 20 bikes ready and all of those sorts of things, I'm thinking once off is probably about right for me right now, but let's see where we are in a year from now.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, I'm going to break us off for a lovely song. This is a terrific song called Bike by a band, Victorian band called Totally Gorgeous, and that gorgeous is spelled G-O-U-R-D. So as in the pumpkins. It's a really fun song about bike riding. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. I'm Kate Conroy and this is A Climate Affair.
Push on a pedal, push on a pedal, get your heart started. Push on a pedal, push it down and up again. Push on a pedal, push on a pedal, get your heart started. Push on a pedal, push it down and up again. Get on your bike, sit on the seat. Put your feet on the pedals and rattle all around, get on your bike, sit on the seat, put your feet on the pedals and rattle all around, oh, get that car out of my way, I wanna ride my bike today, it keeps me fit, gets me there, I won't go stinking off the air, leave behind the daily grind, I'll let your mind unwind, but if it's life, pretend to lie, you better get yourself a bike, oh, get yourself a bike, oh,
You're listening to A Climate Affair. This is Kate Conroy, and I'm on the phone right now with Stephen Gale, who's a cyclist and advocate of the new electric bikes, which are sweeping Australia and certainly the world. And we've just been finding out about his plan to ride this bike with a bunch of other people from Melbourne to Sydney along the Coast Road, which is very beautiful, and along the beach there. So you're going to be taking any, you know, dips in the ocean? I mean, how many breaks do you get on this crazy trip?
I'm hoping to stop at just about every beach on the way, actually. Having seen them, they're simply stunning. They're pristine waters and beaches. Nobody else seems to use them. So it would just be a crime to whiz by and not see any of it.
It would be an absolute crime. My favourite beach in the world is Pretty Beach, which is just south of Ulladulla, north of Batemans Bay.
I saw it on the way.
Did you?
It is very pretty indeed.
Oh, you've got to go there because it's a national park and they don't actually allow day trippers. Oh, I suppose you might be a day tripper, but maybe if you sneak in. But it's so gorgeous with the kangaroos and the rosellas, and it's really sort of true Oz down that way, don't you think?
Those kind of things actually are very strong in reminding me why I really want to do things like this, actually. It sounds a bit pretty to say something like that, but it is really hard not to get a lump in your throat when you see that sort of beauty.
Don't worry, we get lumps in our throat about the environment all the time up here, so
okay.
You're welcome to share it. And in fact, it makes me think, do you have a sort of, obviously this is really important for the electric bike progression, but perhaps there's something more important to be said about slowing down our lifestyles with the journey that you're going to be on?
It's something I think about. I often ride to just about anywhere I go to. In fact, the trip that I take most days is about 30 or so kilometres, so it gives me about an hour to ponder all kinds of things. And I do think about that. Somehow trickling along at 30 kilometres an hour rather than barging in and out of traffic, it really does cause you to stop and think. And so I ponder all sorts of things. I'm sure that's not a bad thing to be doing.
No, I'm sure it isn't a bad thing to be doing. I think bicycle riders probably have a different mindset when it comes down to it to car drivers. Do you think that's right?
It could be, although I was a car driver not really all that long ago, and I can't say that I've suddenly become the mad keen cyclist, although I like it a lot more than I used to. I really, the last time I used a bike was probably about the week before I got my car licence, but now I've actually taken to it. I do quite like getting around by that means.
So perhaps it's part of your message then that no, you don't have to be a rabid cyclist to be someone who could be behind the electric bike. So you're not really even someone who was a huge bicyclist, and now you've become more of one perhaps.
I didn't have a bike before, but now I've got several of them. In fact, I'm about to have 20 or so.
it's a lot of bike.
It is a lot of bikes, yeah.
So tell us more about your life apart from this ride. I read in your bio that you've become very involved in solar energy, another very important development for Australia. Tell us more about that.
I think solar's going to be a big part of the energy mix for us. We've obviously got a lot of sun, and it makes good sense to be exploiting it. One of the problems we've had with flat plate panel systems, they're just very expensive, and the cost of putting them in a widespread use across Australia has tended to be prohibitive for most people. What I'm trying to do is work on a means where we can use concentrator systems to effectively reduce the amount of solar cell that we use to get the same amount of power. I've done a lot of work on that sort of stuff for a company called Solar Systems, who have got a big project going on near Mildura in Victoria here to put in a 150 megawatt solar plant, and I've designed for that company for their tracking systems and things like that cause these big mirrors to follow the sun.
It sounds amazing. On your website, it says that this is going to be the biggest and most efficient solar photovoltaic power station in the world.
That's the numbers they're claiming, and I'd say they're going to do it. They've come up against incredible odds in the past, and they pulled through. I think they'll do it again, and I'll be very, very proud to have been a part of that in my own small way.
What do you wish more ordinary Australians would know about renewable energy?
I guess I'd like it to not be seen as something on the fringe. In other countries, things like wind power and solar are just normal things. They get collectives together in Norway and they put wind farms up and they sell the power back to everyone else that's using it, and that becomes a normal part of business. I believe that's quite a possibility for here as well, especially with the resources of solar, which we've obviously got a hell of a lot of. We don't have a whole lot of cloud most of the time. So it seems crazy not to use that.
And so what's the biggest difficulty for solar power at the moment, do you think?
The big one is getting the costs right down. And that's what I'm hoping to have some input into. I've actually teamed up with a company in America who makes solar concentrators. And my bit is to make the bit that points it in the right direction. So we'll be looking at doing that at a level of putting it onto people's roofs and things like that. So this is a pretty neat little unit that basically a handyman could attach to his roof and within some hours of buying the thing at a Bunnings or equivalent, be putting power back into his grid. Now, obviously, that's a pretty major call, so it's no small thing I'm talking about here. But I believe that's putting it back into the hands of the average person, I think, has got a lot going for it.
Do you think Australians are more prepared to sort of take on individual projects in the light of the water crisis, where people are putting in water tanks crazily at the moment? Do you think that's going to help solar power?
It's interesting because the thing I notice often where I see these quite heroic efforts of saving water, which is really impressive, interestingly, very often you don't see the bit that came before it, which is what led to the water crisis in the first place. It's arguable that it's all caused by climate change, but I'm sure that that's part of the picture. It seems curious that on one hand, people would be prepared to do things like carry buckets of water outside and water their plants, but then on the other, not actually recognise that maybe the other aspects of CO2 emission might have had something to do with it in the first place, and perhaps our lifestyles might have contributed to that.
Yes, people find it difficult, don't they, to connect up the holistic aspect of their lives and how it impacts.
It is a big leap when you think you're one of X billion people. It's pretty hard to recognise that you're part of that. Now, admittedly, 1/1,000,000,000th of a part of that, but when there's 1 billion people all doing that, then we end up with some big numbers.
Do you think, I mean, with your engineering background, do you think that you guys don't get enough credit from environmentalists for how you contribute to solving Australia's problems?
I'm not really too concerned about that, and I guess if you really looked at it, probably the engineers created half a mess in the first place.
Well, it's an interesting question, and it leads me on to another topic. Now, I don't know if you have been keeping up with the water issue in Australian news at the moment, but have you heard of the Bradfield plan for the water?
That's the one to pipe water from Queensland to Victoria and New South Wales?
That's the one, yeah. You heard about that?
I certainly have.
Did you know that it was the engineer for the Sydney Harbour Bridge who came up with the concept?
I had actually read that. It wasn't on the tip of my tongue, but so it turned out.
Yeah, and did you know that the real plan is not just for it to go to Victoria, New South Wales, but it's also really to get it into South Australia with the final plan that it goes into Lake Eyre, and then it's supposed to evaporate off into the sky and then produce enormous amounts of rainfall for Central Australia.
That's staggering.
Yeah, that's the actual plan. I mean, I'd only just read about that today. I couldn't believe it.
I wonder if anyone's actually costed that.
I think that's one of the big criticisms of the plan since it was suggested back in the 40s.
Well, I guess when you put costs of things, as we see often with climate change and those sort of matters, things become pretty expensive when you start talking about putting back areas that were damaged. It's actually a lot more expensive to do that than it is not to wreck it in the first place. And that's, I guess that's an example of that, that when the people that are complaining that Australia is going to miss out on so much money from exports of coal and things like that, we say, well, yes, and the other part of it is we're going to get a lot of costs from the various impacts of climate change, and that's going to be borne somewhere as well.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to take a little break to listen to some music. This is another Brisbane band, FAQ, a song All Over the World. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. This is A Climate Affair, and I'm Kate Conroy. And we are talking about electric cycles, bicycles, with Stephen Gale. And, of course, being A Climate Affair, I've decided to bring discussion into all sorts of other areas that Stephen is involved with. So is there a message you'd like to give to the listeners of this program, Stephen?
Thanks, Kate. We're going to be on this epic adventure, and I think it's going to be an awfully good time. We've still got about 8 or so places for people to come with us. And so if you've got a company and you'd like to represent it in a good light, as being some people that care about the environment and these sorts of issues, and probably if you're listening to this station, then that's what you are. If you've got a bit of a sense of adventure and you want to come on a really good bike ride, get in touch with us off our website and we'd love to talk to you.
And what's your website?
All the W's, suitabletransport.com.
And suitable, how do we spell suitable?
As in S-U-I-T-A-B-L-E.
suitabletransport.com if you're interested in joining Stephen Gale on his ride. How much would it cost to go on the ride?
I'm getting a bike, I'm feeding people, I'm putting them in accommodation for a total of $2,000, but they keep the bike afterwards.
Wow, that seems like a really good deal.
It's what it costs, basically. I'm not getting anything out of that left over, and in fact, by the time I put the launch together and all of those sorts of matters, then I'll be going pretty well backwards, but that's okay. But if you come along, then it really helps to make it a good event.
What if I was a company that thought, oh, look, I'm not sure I can actually cycle, but maybe can I sponsor you apart from cycling? I mean, can I put sponsorship on the bikes or something?
Oh, no. We're way above accepting anything like that. Absolutely. Anything like that would be perfectly welcome.
So you would accept monetary donations?
If either that or things in kind, obviously we've got a lot of stuff that's needed to make this all happen. And certainly in terms of catering and putting on a exciting breakfast or something like that, or lunch for us to arrive to in Sydney, these are all possibilities. So any help's most welcome.
Excellent. And what about an individual? What if an individual listening to my show thought that this was a perfect opportunity for them? Were you taking individual offers as well?
Of course. We're looking for people that have got a bit of spunk, so they're willing to put on a costume that looks pretty interesting. Just imagine it's 1,000 kilometres worth of theatre, and I'd really like it if the people that are being involved sort of treated it in that sort of way. So if you're the right type of person and you're interested in coming along on what'll be a great time, sure, we'd love to hear from you.
Absolutely. Look, it sounds like an absolute riot. Are you going to have it all filmed?
Yes, we've got a filmmaker coming with us. He's going to ride the initial bit looking like a filmmaker. We haven't quite worked out what that is. And then he'll be filming most of the journey. In fact, there'll be probably 2 camera people along with us. And there's a possibility we might make a doco out of this if enough good material happens.
Terrific. Look, I'm sure there'll be some entertainment, especially if it's by those beautiful beaches that Australia has locked away in secret.
I think if you've got 20 people, then you can pretty much expect there'll be some interesting interactions. That's fairly much guaranteed.
It's got to be better than Big Brother, and Big Brother gets all the ratings, so I'm sure it'll be fantastic.
Big Brother of electric bike rides.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Right. Well, this is good. So one of the other things that you are interested in or have discovered is you had a car accident, apparently, a few years ago, and that dramatically changed a transport decision. Apart from cycling, what was that all about?
I was on my way to one of the solar power stations, and the drive is a long way in a car. These are in the middle of New South Wales. This particular one was central New South Wales. And as I was mindlessly driving along, as I'd done for about 8 hours already, I took a corner a bit too fast and then noticed the horizon was toppling about 6 or 7 times, and then the car was sliding on its roof.
Oh my goodness.
Oddly enough, I just walked away from it. It didn't really affect me all that much. I don't think it sort of had some deep-rooted psychological effect. I'm not so sure about the passenger, but the thing that I did decide after that was that I really didn't like driving very much, and particularly not for those sort of distances or in those kind of places. And I made a vow that the next time I did that trip, it'd be in an aircraft.
And so you learnt to fly.
Well, that's the obvious way to do it. If you want to fly somewhere, then, yeah, you better learn to fly.
Most people get a ticket, but you thought, nope, I'm going to take the bull by the horn, so to speak.
That's right.
Well, that's fantastic. And in your experience as someone who flies across Australia in the endeavour to spread solar power, what do you think the perspective, and we're talking about perspective in regards to cycling before and how that contrasts with the view of the road, flying obviously is much faster than cars. Does it give you a different perspective on things?
It certainly does. Just seeing the extent and size of Australia and seeing all those dams which are completely dry, seeing an awful lot of land that just has almost nothing on it, a lot of it really is very, very arid land, you discover that Australia's populated at the nice bits, where there's water and trees and all of those sorts of things. But actually, a very large part of Australia, there isn't a lot other than a fair bit of dirt. And it certainly makes you realise when we talk about growing deserts and things like that, boy, there's a fair opportunity for them to grow.
Yeah, we've got good, excellent, fertile growing deserts. Yeah, they're growing like anything.
That's right. Yeah.
certainly... It's my experience on plane trips I take, the same sort of thing. You see the great sort of barrenness and the sort of terrifying situation of the dams. And then I also feel a bit guilty about all the fuel that I'm obviously using on those airplane flights. You've got a solution, or you're trying to implement a solution to reducing the use of fossil fuels in plane flights. Is that
well,
right?
Well, it's hardly my solution, but the obvious equations when you start to look at transport seem to be that cars and things like that, mostly we can deal with either generating our electricity by solar, using batteries or creating hydrogen fuel. But there's not a whole lot we can do about aviation. And the simple fact is, if we want to fly planes, there's not really a lot of options other than ethanol fuel. That's if you don't want to burn carbon fuels. That's where I see it's probably going to head, largely because there isn't a whole lot of alternatives.
Yeah, well, certainly it's a difficult area in regards to renewable energy. Ethanol is really interesting. In America, the US, ethanol mostly comes from corn, which requires an enormous amount of chemicals to be added to the soil and creates its own environmental problems from an agricultural perspective. Is that the same in Australia?
We tend to use sugarcane, which I can't claim to be much of an expert on. The one that appears to be particularly interesting is switchgrass, and that appears to be something that will grow in a fairly arid sort of area and still gives a pretty good yield in terms of the amount of fuel you can get from that. It's a very low intensity sort of farming, so we're not talking about having to use vast amounts of fertilisers and things like that to make it happen.
So
that's certainly one of the criticisms that's levelled at ethanol fuel, is that for the energy that you use to put it together is barely, you're not getting that much more from the fuel that you create. I think a lot of those figures are skewed because I've seen that ranging from 20 to 80%, so it's obviously a number somewhere in between. But clearly using crops that are a little bit more efficient as far as producing fuel is a pretty important step.
Absolutely. It seems like a big problem in the US, their focus and obsession with corn. But switchgrass is Australia's current solution, which sounds really interesting, and I certainly don't know enough about switchgrass to say informed things about it, but it's worth, you know, folks at home who are listening, if they're interested in the ethanol production cycle, maybe to put that into Google and see what comes up and, you know, what is our environmental status for things like sugarcane. Is that a viable crop, or is it like rice, which is, you know, probably not a viable crop in Australia?
I gather when it's grown in the right sorts of places, typically that's Townsville and north of there, it's actually not too bad, and it's not a nasty crop to grow in those kind of places. They certainly don't have a lack of water or anything like that.
No.
I was surprised. There's a company, Agri Energy, who's built a plant at Minidri in South Australia, border of South Australia, Victoria. They built a plant that's got the capabilities of supplying, I think, 30 or 25% of Australia's LPG, unleaded fuel requirements in one plant, and they can feed that from just the sugarcane that's currently exported.
Wow.
And the farmers will get more for their crop than they would if it was exported.
So are you telling us that we have a company in Australia that not only is utilising agricultural output from our farmers, so helping our economy on the farming level, but is reducing our reliance on overseas fossil fuel?
That's right. They're a new company, but they're struggling actually to get acceptance of putting even 10% of ethanol into car engines, which is interesting. There's been a fair bit of resistance against that. And yet, from what I can see, there's no very good reasons for doing that. It appears not to cause any harm to the engines, as I can see. Yet even getting that through is giving them grief. But there we go.
That sounds very political. I was only listening the other day to the fact that the US has got a percentage of ethanol in all of its unleaded fuels, and it's been mandated for a couple of years. And Henry Ford originally said that ethanol was the fuel of the future because we couldn't possibly keep having cars if we keep being reliant on the oil. So,
well, yeah, that's in times of war, that's been a standard one to run aircraft and things like that. That's been done for a long time.
So it seems like it may be less to do with the science and more to do with the genders.
I'd say so.
Yeah. Well, look, it's been really terrific talking with you today. I hope our listeners have got something out of the conversation, whether it's about the bikes or the solar power, or now we've been talking about ethanol production. I guess it's, you know, good luck on your journey.
Thanks very much, Kate. I think we'll be having a good time, but I appreciate your support.
Absolutely. Now, just give us one more time the web address so that if people want to learn more about what you're up to, where they can go.
Okay. That one's www.suitabletransport.com. as in suit, as in business suit.
And it's .com, not .au?
That's correct.
So just suitabletransport.com if you want to learn more about Stephen Gale and his riding and what he gets up to with the electric bicycles. All right, well, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
Bye then.
Bye. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. I'm Kate Conroy, and you're listening to A Climate Affair this afternoon, and I'm excited to announce we have another guest on the show today. We've got Glenn Walker from the Wilderness Society. Hi, Glenn. Welcome.
G'day, Kate. Thanks for having me along tonight.
Terrific. So tell us what the Wilderness Society is up to at the moment.
Well, at the moment, particularly in Queensland, a lot of our attention is focused on recent announcements from both the Queensland government and the federal government to divert the water from our wild rivers of the north for large-scale irrigation development. So I'll just go into a bit of detail very briefly about those two, separating them. So the federal government, a few weeks ago, when the Prime Minister announced his $10 million fund to fix the Murray-Darling Basin, bundled in that was also a task force looking at irrigation in the north. And to us, that signalled the code similar to the nuclear task force, that there was a predetermined result for this. People like Bill Heffernan and Bob Catter already know what they want to do with the north. They already know that they want to plug the rivers of the north for irrigated development. So the Prime Minister and the federal government is moving to set themselves up to establish large-scale irrigation, large dams on our northern river system. So that's one part of it. The second part is a very curious announcement from the Beattie government last week, which is a reinvigoration of the Bradfield scheme. And it's a very interesting proposition that was put together by an engineer back in the 1930s. And this is essentially about diverting the great rivers from the north into the south. The original idea was diverting the river all the way to Lake Eyre Basin to create more rainfall for this vast agricultural area, which is completely flawed on so many environmental
Sounds
grounds.
Terrific. Tell us, what's wrong? Why won't it create rainfall if we divert water to Lake Eyre?
Well, we already know. If you just have to look at the West Australian coast, just because water is in an area doesn't particularly mean that it's going to create evaporation. There's a whole range of environmental conditions at play here. And a thing to remember in Lake Eyre Basin, of course, is soil type as well. And this is also something we're seeing in northern Australia, that the soil type, because it's ancient soils in Australia, are not appropriate for this form of irrigated agriculture. So just getting back to the Bradfield scheme and where Beattie was taking this idea, basically what he's proposing to fix the Murray-Darling Basin is to divert water more than 1,000 kilometres from the Tully and Herbert Rivers near Cairns all the way down, channeling it through some of our western rivers, so completely altering the nature of our western river systems and diverting it into the top of the Warrego, which is at the top of the Murray-Darling Basin system in Queensland. Now, that's a huge scheme, hugely environmentally damaging, not just for the northern rivers, not just because you're taking water out of those river systems and away from and taking water quality and important flows away from the Great Barrier Reef, but you're fundamentally changing the natural flows of a number of river systems where you're pumping it to. So I guess...
Can I just stop you right there for a sec?
Sure.
The Great Barrier Reef is an interesting question. I was only recently reading that the Great Barrier Reef actually suffers every single year from the massive silt that runs off from the flooding from the wet season. So isn't there an argument that we could be helping the Great Barrier Reef by at least dealing? I mean, obviously we do get floodwaters that are in excess of what helps the cane growers suffer from all this excess floodwater, $30 million worth of damage every single year to a whole bunch of industry in northern Queensland. I mean, isn't there a way to get that floodwater away from damaging the Great Barrier Reef or farmers and then being able to utilise it? I mean, what's so bad about that?
Look, the solution to that isn't about taking the water out of the system, because the water is critical to a number of areas in that catchment. It's not just the Great Barrier Reef. But the solution to that is to improve our land management, particularly in our cane-growing systems where we see a lot of this sediment, where we see a lot of these nutrients running out into the system and excess of it flowing into the Great Barrier Reef and causing all sorts of problems with the health of Great Barrier Reef. So I don't think the solution is taking the flows out. It's addressing our land management issues in the Great Barrier Reef, particularly in those hot spots around Cairns and further south near Townsville.
Maybe you could tell me a bit more about that. So how would we change the land management usage in Far North Queensland to help in these situations?
As a start, we need to dramatically reduce, if not stop, our use of pesticides, because that is a critical, critical issue in Great Barrier Reef catchments. The nutrification of these waters is causing all sorts of health problems with the Great Barrier Reef, and it's very well documented. There's a lot of scientific evidence to show that. So I think the first step is to stop the use of pesticide and fundamentally change our agricultural farming systems. And look, we have to look at the value. We have to look at the economic value we're gaining out of these crops and the Great Barrier Reef catchments, compared to the tourist bucks that are flowing from the Great Barrier Reef, and compared to the aesthetic values, and compared to the natural wonder that is the Great Barrier Reef. We have to weigh these things up together and make some hard decisions about what is an appropriate agricultural area. And this is a debate that's raging through the Murray-Darling Basin at the moment. What areas are appropriate to grow what in Australia? And we need to have this same debate in Great Barrier Reef catchments as well, I think.
Yeah, so what should Australia grow? Given it's the same problem. I mean, this is a really big question. Well, what does the Wilderness Society advocate for crops for Australia?
Look, we don't advocate certain crops because it's very localised depending on the particular local system, the particular soil types, about what you can grow. But what I can say is in Australia, for example, in 2004, we wasted $5.6 billion worth of food. So I think if we can, and I'll just tell you where this statistic's coming from. It's coming from the Australia Institute, a report that was put out in 2005 about wasteful consumption in Australia. So I think what we should be doing is looking at peeling back our wasteful consumption of food, and that way we can peel back some of these agricultural areas that are fundamentally altering the landscape in Australia and fundamentally damaging our river systems. It's hard to get into a debate about exactly what sort of crops, although I can say with qualification that cotton in the top of our Murray-Darling Basin system is extremely damaging, it's extremely inefficient with water, and it's something we have to seriously re-examine and look at buying out some of these properties instead of these big schemes from the north.
It seems to me that the Australian government's been subsidising cotton by giving it an enormous amount of water that the government has to pay for, and that the farmers don't really pay the true cost of getting that water there. Is that right?
Well, this is one of the key facets of the National Water Initiative. And the National Water Initiative is something that the key states, particularly in the Murray-Darling Basin, the Commonwealth have signed up to, and it's agreement for reform in water in Australia. And one of the key facets of that is to start charging farmers, is to start charging water users for the water that they're using, because prior to now, and still we're seeing now, particularly in some of these large-scale cotton properties, they're paying very, very little for their water, and they're extremely inefficient with their water, and it's killing our river system. So it's critically important that we address that and start charging the real cost of the water for these resources.
You mentioned that Australians were very wasteful with food. I wasn't sure exactly. What are we doing that's wasteful?
We're eating, for example, you eat a couple of bites of a hamburger and you throw the rest out in the bin. I think everyone out there listening can recognise sometimes we'll eat half a meal and just chuck it in the scrap heap. I think, and if you look in a bin of any major supermarket, you'll see that they're throwing out very useful food 1 or 2 days before it's used by date because of certain health standards that have been in place. And I think we need to be looking as a nation at how we consume food and how we waste food and how we can increase our efficiency with eating food and using food as a resource in the context of, well, hang on, this wasteful consumption of food is one of the root causes of these issues in the Murray-Darling Basin and these issues of stresses on our river systems and agricultural systems.
I don't know. I worry that the blaming of, you know, mum down at the supermarket who gets food for her kids, it's yet another thing where the average Australian is going to take all of this burden, and yet it seems to me it's squarely because of industrial practices that we have most of the water problems, and that the actual crops that are grown, the fact that Australians, our diet should change. That seems like a big thing to me. Like maybe if we ate less hamburgers, for example,
I don't disagree about the industrialisation and that being a major factor in this, and that's probably one of the root causes, again, of wasteful consumption, that, you know, food is produced in a factory-like setting and there's so much that goes to waste through that type of system. So I'm certainly not blaming mum down the street for her wasteful consumption of the food. In fact, I think a lot of the finger-pointing should be at governments for overarching policy that's guided this mismanagement of our river systems for so many decades, and it needs rapid addressing at the moment.
With the managing of Australia's systems, one of the things that you wrote about, the Wilderness Society wrote about, was the problems of damming and changing and diverting North Queensland's water will replicate the same disastrous effects that have now hit the Murray River system. Perhaps you could be careful and help my listeners understand what went wrong with the Murray-Darling system so that we can understand what might go wrong with the Queensland River diversions.
It's very much a case of death by a thousand cuts. It was incremental issuing of water licences and not having a holistic view of what was happening in the whole of catchment if you take the Murray-Darling Basin. And I guess it's that it was an old world view that of the frontier territory of Australia that we as a nation to become a successful nation, a successful civilization, we had to conquer nature, we had to conquer these vast river systems, we had to establish irrigated agriculture, and therefore we applied a European farming system to an Australian landscape, to a dry continent.
Are you advocating not using irrigation?
Look, I'm not going to advocate not using irrigation because I think in some areas we can use irrigation. But what I'm saying is that large-scale irrigation like cotton that we're seeing in the top end of the Murray-Darling Basin is inappropriate. And as a nation, we have to start reassessing the types of irrigation we're using, the types of farming methods we're using in critical catchments where we're seeing critical environmental issues occur.
What kind of criteria might people have to consider in the reworking of Australia's waters? I mean, what kind of things should a farmer think about?
Oh, look, the erosion of soil through land clearing, the mobilisation of salts through that same farming method, the impact on water quality in a river system through their particular farming method, whether they're putting impoundments on the rivers, which, you know, we're talking about dams and dams, you know, they stop fish flow, they fundamentally change the chemistry of a river system. So all of those things would be bundled into this sort of criteria and weighing up the economic viability of an area compared to the environmental costs and the environmental damage it's causing.
One of the things that's really interesting about the current debate is it is focusing Australia's attention on how limited our water is. One of the issues, of course, that Australians have to face is some form of balance between the use of water, say, for irrigation or human-related activities, and perhaps keeping wilderness areas free from interaction and so forth. So let's go to a song, but then when we come back after the break, maybe we can talk about what kinds of percentages or what kinds of areas Australia needs to aim at in order to protect some of our areas from any form of human interaction.
Sure, I can answer that extensively.
Terrific. Planet Radio 88 FM. We're talking to Glenn Walker from the Wilderness Society on A Climate Affair this afternoon. Hi, Glenn. Welcome back.
Thank you, Kate.
So one of the things that is a very difficult issue in Australia is what do we do with domestic water supplies or water supplies for humans? And you know, what are we supposed to do if the Wilderness Society thinks that we're not supposed to divert all this water from the north and use it for agriculture, or, you know, we're not supposed to touch it? What are we supposed to do? Just leave it all sitting around? And how much of Australia should we just leave to the birds? I mean, shouldn't we have some area for humans to actually be able to survive?
Look, I think all areas in Australia are areas for humans to survive, and I just wanted to clear up something where the Wilderness Society, and there's an old idea about wilderness, which is a landscape void of humans. We don't actually believe in that, and particularly in Australia, we recognise that the traditional owners have played a very key role in the fundamental shape of the Australian landscape. They've nurtured this landscape. They've been embedded in the landscape, and through their fire management systems, through their governance structures, which saw that through the clan and language group structures all through Australia, this has guided the shape of the Australian landscape. So we very much still need humans in the landscape to manage a landscape at that level. And I think that in urban settings, we also have to understand that, yes, we too are embedded in this landscape and we can work with the Australian environment if we can understand it and learn to love it. And just getting on the issue of domestic water use, in Southeast Queensland, for example, we could make huge savings if we were serious about this through a number of measures by changing our shower water heads, by installing rainwater tanks. We could save up to 50% through all these measures alone, just in the home, and through water recycling. In Queensland, in Southeast Queensland, we consume about 480,000 megalitres a year. That's about the volume of Sydney Harbour. Now, we can recycle, there's a potential to recycle almost half of that.
Half of it. That'd be amazing.
Half of it to a standard that's purer than the water that's currently in the dams at the moment. So there is a lot of potential to use our water more wisely, and we have to replicate this through all cities and in the rural landscape as well.
It's amazing to imagine that correct use of our water resources would mean retaining 50% of the water that we used every year. I mean, that means 50%. Half of our water, we would not even have to worry about rain. At all.
Exactly. And this is one of the issues and one of the things about having rainwater tanks in this catchment. Everyone would be familiar at the moment that it's been raining. We've had rain for the past few weeks, but hasn't been raining in the dam catchments because they're in a rain shadow. It's like standing inside with a bucket waiting for the rains to come. It ain't going to happen. You've got to install a rainwater tank if you can, and we've got to look at water recycling because we have to get smarter about our water use. And we know all these things, but what we need is political leadership, and we have to keep pushing our politicians. We have to write letters to them. We have to join environmental groups or other community groups that are pressuring the government to see these sort of initiatives come through, and it's critical everyone out there gets involved.
If people do want to get involved, how would they get in contact with the Wilderness Society, for example?
www.wilderness.org.au is our main website, and on that there's a very clear button that you can click on, which is Get Involved. Every Thursday night here in Brisbane, we have a wilderness action group, which is basically we have around 15 to 20 people, and we discuss current environmental issues and what we're going to do about it. And that includes, you know, developing community actions, developing letter writing campaigns, all sorts of things. So it's a really great way to get involved. So you can either visit our website, www.wilderness.org.au, or call us on 3846 1420.
The Wilderness Society as an organisation, what has it actually done to help the environment? I mean, you talk a lot, but do you actually do anything?
We've done a hell of a lot. We've played a big role. And look, you know, it's not just the Wilderness Society. The Wilderness Society is a grassroots organisation. So you have to recognise that we're a community-based organisation. There's been a lot of people that played a role. But to fire off some big wins we've had, we've saved Fraser Island from sand mining. We've saved Shelburne Bay on Cape York from sand mining. We've stopped land clearing, which is one of the biggest environmental wins, I would say, on the planet, because Queensland was clearing like there was no tomorrow, almost at a rate of Brazil if you consider it as a separate country. So we played a critical role in that.
Like to interrupt you right there.
As I'm spieling.
As you're spieling. No, because I think it's important, you know, for people to stop and pause sometimes at some of these wins, because the land clearing of Queensland, you guys have helped save an area of land the size of Victoria in terms of forest.
It's an amazing win, and it was community resolve, and it was drilling the politicians and keeping them accountable for what they're there for. They're our elected representatives. We need to tell them that they represent us and they represent our values, and this is what happened in the land clearing campaign. We stood back and said, well, hang on, we don't want all this land cleared. We don't want all these species dying. We don't want to leave this ruined landscape for generations to come. We want you to fix it. We want you to stop it. We want you to act now. And that's what they did through some very good campaigning through our organisation, in other environmental groups and the community. And because of that, I have to say, in the climate change debate, that is the very reason, if it is one of the key reasons, that we're meeting our Kyoto target at the moment, which is a very generous target, because Australia negotiated when Kyoto was going through that we would have 8% above 1990 levels, unlike minus 8% for most other nations. So we've got ourselves a very good bargain, and the reason we're meeting that is because of the end of land clearing in Queensland. Yeah. That's one of the key reasons.
Just to clarify this to you guys, just by not clearing trees in Queensland from now on. Now, this is broad-scale clearing. This is massive, massive clearing. Just by not doing anything, we're going to meet our Kyoto target. Now, Australia hasn't ratified the Kyoto Protocol. The government hasn't. Nevertheless, we actually have a standard, and by changing this law, which went into effect the 1st of January 2007, which is when the broad-scale clearing stopped, we have managed to meet this target. I mean, it's really astounding.
It is astounding. And you know, a lot of the debate from the federal government at the moment is that we've met our Kyoto targets. This is about working with all nations. Like, well, you've met it because we stopped land clearing, and because of these measures, and because of hard campaigning from a lot of environmental organisations. And we have to keep telling them that. We have to keep letting them know. And the reason, you know, just quickly getting back to basics, the reason why by land clearing has stopped that huge increase in climate change gases is because carbon is stored through natural ecosystems, through forest systems. So by not clearing it, we haven't released that carbon dioxide, and that's just a quick explanation of the reason behind that.
No, that's good. That's good. I think a balance of the science and the emotions is an excellent. Certainly, my aim on.
It's easy to get away on these issues.
No, look, it is, and sometimes it can be very overwhelming emotionally. I think to people, they say, "Oh, maybe I don't even hear about the news. It's so doom and gloom."
But look, this is why I'm happy that you asked these questions about what have we done, because that is a key win. And look, another key win that I really want to highlight at the moment is Wild Rivers for Queensland. This is something that Wilderness Society has fought hard for the past 7 years, and we convinced the government to adopt policy to protect some of these wild rivers we're talking about. And just last week, we saw the official protection of the first 6 wild rivers. And what it does, it regulates unsustainable development. So it's very sensible legislation. It stops the kind of development that's destroyed the Murray-Darling Basin. It stops major dams, it stops major weirs, it stops large-scale irrigation, and it strictly regulates mining. So it's very sensible legislation. We campaigned hard for it, and we're now campaigning to see that across the whole of North Australia, where a lot of our free-flowing rivers are.
So tell me more about the wild rivers of northern Queensland. I mean, what's the human population once you get north of Fraser Island? I mean, how many people are out there?
Off the top of my head, I can't give you that figure, to be honest. It's very sparsely populated in comparison to the rest of Australia, I have to say that, and it's the same case with Central Australia. And we're very lucky that in this region, in northern Australia, most of these rivers are still flowing, still free-flowing. We don't have big dams on them. We don't have large-scale irrigation systems. Therefore, the landscape is in a much healthier state, and we have this amazing opportunity to protect these wild rivers and to stop this form of unsustainable development that the federal government is proposing and that Peter Beattie is proposing through his big pipeline.
Tell me, I mean, if I've never been up there to these areas and seen these wild river systems, what sort of economic advantages could we possibly get from retaining the wild rivers in their natural forms?
Huge. I'll give you an example of the Gulf of Carpentaria, where 4 of the wild rivers I just spoke about have been declared. One is through the fisheries, the sustainable fisheries in the Gulf of Carpentaria. These are multi-million dollars. We're talking about $300 million, the value of particularly the prawn fisheries in the Gulf, sustainable fisheries. And the fish catch and the prawn catch is correlated with natural flows, which means if you stop those natural flows, if you impede those natural flows, then you're going to see a reduction in catch and a reduction in the money you're getting back from your fisheries in those systems. So that's one economic benefit through fisheries.
Let me get this straight. So Australians, when we go to, you know, get fish, I mean, I've been so bamboozled by the gloom and doom stories about our food, and I think, oh goodness, I shouldn't eat meat because it uses so much water in order to produce each pound of beef. Not only is that, but it's often produced in terribly unethical fashions. So I think, well, maybe I should become a vegetarian. But then they say, oh, well, women need to eat heaps of fish and my brain needs omega-3s. And I think, oh, crikey.
It's
well, I really, you know, I love fish. It's beautiful, and it's sort of an Australian tradition to eat the stuff. And then I read stories that fishmongers don't even have Australian fish, that they're getting fish from other countries, which isn't of itself terrible except for the fossil fuels required to bring it here. But then I worry about dynamiting fish beds in Southeast Asia and unregulated fishing areas in China and pollution and runoff. But we actually have prawn fisheries here in Australia.
We do, and in particularly in the north, as I was saying, the Gulf of Carpentaria, and that's a key economic base for that region. And it relies on us having free-flowing, healthy wild rivers. And this is why we want to protect them. So that's one economic reason. The other economic reason is through ecotourism, which is huge potential in the north. There's beautiful wild rivers that people want to see, they want to visit, they want to go fishing on. Another economic base is another policy that we've generated through this Wild River Initiative in the 4 catchments, the 4 river systems that have now been declared and now officially protected. The Queensland government, a bit schizophrenic with the policies. So, you know, on one hand, they're protecting these beautiful rivers, and on one hand, they're proposing big pipelines, but we'll get to that later. What they've promised for these wild river systems is establishing a program for Indigenous wild river rangers. So what it means, in the Gulf of Carpentaria, it'll be 20 jobs. In Cape York, where the next wild rivers are due to be protected, there'll be 80. But what we're looking at is a creation of local jobs for Indigenous people where they can stay on country, they can care for country, they can look after these river systems, and they can get back to their spiritual and cultural roots in that sense. And it's an incredibly inspiring programmed to see up and running. It's not up and running at the moment, but it will be incredibly inspiring to see it up and running. And this is the type of economic paradigm we need to see in the North. We need to flip the current thinking, the current economic thinking on its head, and establish this new paradigm for the North, a conservation economy, economic activities that agree with the natural function of river systems, that agree with the natural function of healthy landscapes. And it's possible. And this is something that the Wilderness Society is working hard on. And we're working hard with a lot of businesses in the North to establish a framework of what defines a sustainable business. And we're very, very positive about it. We think we can show to people that you can have a sustainable form of economic development in these areas that doesn't have to involve screwing up our river systems and clearing the land.
This is so important and so interesting, but we're going to have a little break and hear a song before we come right back. Planet Radio 88 FM, I'm Kate Conroy and you're listening to A Climate Affair. We are in the middle of talking to the Wilderness Society representative of Wild River Campaigns, Glenn Walker, and we've been discussing the notion of being able to create industry in Australia's top end, which actually retains the natural ecosystems, which is sort of, in one way, I guess, obvious, but in another way, it seems almost at loggerheads with the traditional message a lot of us grew up with. So tell us more about that.
Wilderness Society has been pioneering a new idea, and it's called Wild Country. And basically what it's doing, it's challenging the old idea that we can just simply lock up areas for national parks and have these, basically these islands of so-called nature in a sea of human disturbance. And so what we've done, we've been speaking very carefully with some of the world's most foremost conservation biologists and conservation scientists, and we've come up with this new approach to conservation planning, and we've subsequently formed what's called the Wilderness Society Science Council for them to guide through science, through cutting edge science, our policy. So what Wild Country means is that instead of having these protected areas and a sea of human disturbance, as I said before, you have your core protected areas, and between your core protected areas, you have a matrix of policy, and you have a matrix of land protection systems that ensures connectivity between your core protected areas. Because fundamentally, in any landscape, particularly in the North, an area that is still very intact on a global scale, it's critical that species can move across the landscape, that the rivers are still free flowing, that we protect all of these large scale ecological processes. So this is what Wild Country is trying to do. Rather than looking at just protected areas, we're looking at frameworks like Wild Rivers that will regulate development in river systems. We're looking at stewardship schemes, so you can provide assistance to landholders into indigenous communities to help manage their land sustainably. So we have a whole of landscape approach rather than a partial landscape approach. And embedded in that is this idea of what we were discussing before, the conservation economy, recognizing, well, if we want a whole of landscape approach, you can't just lock out everybody out of the whole system, which is the old school thinking. So we recognize that, yes, there does have to be some sort of economic activities, but yes, it is possible to have economic activities that agree with this idea, that agree with maintaining these large-scale ecological processes. And that's through ecotourism, that's through sustainable fisheries, that's through paying our indigenous traditional owners, paying landholders in certain circumstances to care for country, to manage the country the way it is. Because we pay rangers in national parks.
Absolutely. And certainly it looks exciting with the establishment or the attempt to develop a wildlife corridor all the way up Australia, which looks like trying to encourage farmers or people who own land to be a part of a system of interconnected land all the way up.
Well, that's interesting you mention that, because this is exactly the type of idea that we're talking about. And I mentioned before the Wilderness Society Science Council, and the Science Council will be getting involved in that project because, as I said before, the stuff these guys have generated is cutting edge, and it's recognised around the world now that, hey, these guys have got something new and this is right and we've struck on something here. If we're serious about protecting biodiversity in the face of climate change, then we have to be thinking big, and we have to, as a community, accept that we're going to have to put funds and resources and energy into connecting these wildlands together so species can move across the landscape.
Yeah, it sounds really holistic and like the right direction. And it also reminds me of the development of environmental policy in the United States, where you contrast the view of John Muir, who developed and instituted the National Park Scheme in America with the Forestry Scheme introduced. And I'm wanting to say Pinchot, but I've got a feeling I've got that name wrong, but I think it's Pinchot. And he was a sort of upper class American guy who got educated at all the best schools. And, you know, he went over to Europe and he saw the terrible condition of France and the devastation, deforestation, loss of species there. And he came back to America and he pioneered the idea of we need national forests that are managed with human endeavor and economic interests, but also carefully regulated in order to maintain the beauty and the aesthetics and the ecosystems that were involved. There was huge clashes going on between John Muir and Pinchot in regards to the alternating policy of do we keep the wild national parks absolutely free of anything versus integrated. And what's fascinating is if you look at a map of the United States now, many years after this was all sort of fought out, is the amount of forest that has been protected by the national parks is a much smaller percentage than the amount of forest that's been protected through the National Forestry Network.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point you raise there. And when I talk about this wild country framework, it's an idea that's been partly borrowed or largely borrowed from a thing called wild lands in the United States. And a lot of that is resting on just what you've been speaking about, that a lot of these forest systems have been fairly well preserved through that particular land tenure you're talking about. And so now the United States and conservation groups over there are looking at what we're doing here as well. So we're essentially doing the same thing, is connecting these forests up as much as we can, targeting key areas in between that might be degraded for restoration. So it's a key guiding principle for our conservation planning and a key guiding principle to ensure that we protect our biodiversity, that we protect all of our animals and plants under the increasing threat from climate change.
It sounds really important. If I'm a, you know, I'm at home right now or, you know, driving home from work or something, a lot of people are really interested in this sort of stuff and they think it's important, but they may not themselves feel like they can do the activism required in order to help. Is there an easy way, like, to be someone who consistently gives to an organisation like the Wilderness Society but doesn't require sort of constant management?
Yeah, look, we've got a very good scheme and you know, we're an entirely community-based organisation. We're entirely independent and we like it that way. We don't like to have funding from tied to specific government sources. So we rely on supporters out there and we rely on people to donate some of their money into the causes that we're fighting for. And it's very easy, you know, you see our canvases on the street and it's very easy. You can donate a minimum of $20 a month, I should say. and through that, you become an active member of the Wilderness Society. You receive updates of our campaigns. You receive newsletters. And you can speak to us regularly about our campaigns and provide us input into what you think, you know, what you think are the critical issues that we should be looking at and have that communication with us. So, it's a very good way for you to get involved and to help donate to an organisation like the Wilderness Society that has a proven track record with very good achievements and that is very ambitious and that has a very proactive vision for how we're going to tackle some of our environmental issues into the future.
Absolutely. Well, look, it's been really great to have you here, Glenn. Thanks so much for your time. I've certainly learned a lot. I hope everyone out there is enjoying a bit more information about the wild rivers of Northern Australia and how we can actually benefit by protecting them rather than spending a fortune on diverting
them. Before we go, just relating to protecting our wild rivers, as I said before, 6 of our wild rivers have been protected and 13 on Cape York are next to be protected. So, it's critical the community gets behind this. Cape York is one of the wildest places left on Earth, one of the most intact areas left on Earth. And we have this incredible tool under wild rivers to protect this area and protect it from unsustainable development, from large dams and weirs and large-scale irrigation that's really degraded the Murray-Darling Basin. So, I encourage everybody out there to help us encourage the government to protect those river systems.
And they can do that by going to your website?
By going to our website, www.wilderness.org.au, or by calling us on 3846 1420.
That's fantastic. Well, hopefully you'll hear some calls on the phone
I
and some hits on the website. Very important work, and congratulations on passing the Wild Rivers legislation.
Excellent.
And on the land clearing deal, which basically means that the Wilderness Society is responsible for us meeting our Kyoto Protocol requirements. Quite an effort from a grassroots organisation, if you ask me. Really good guys. Get involved.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks. For having me along.
I'm Kate Conroy with you this afternoon, and we are going to be running through until 7 p.m. You've just been listening to Glenn from the Wilderness Society talk to us about the Wild Rivers campaigns to protect Northern Australian water sources. Of course, it's incredibly, the timing obviously is incredibly fortuitous given the idea of the Premier of Queensland to divert water from the rivers, Wild Rivers up north, down towards the Murray-Darling River Basin. And it looks as though this is not going to be a great solution for the environment and probably won't be a great economic solution. And perhaps we need a complete paradigm shift of our notion of what constitutes a healthy economy before we make such drastic and irreversible environmental decisions. In great engineering works are terrific. My grandfather was an engineer and I have an enormous amount of respect for that profession. Nevertheless, a certain amount more care needs to be taken before we start damming all of these rivers up north with so much lack of considered potential for the tourism and economy that could come from them. Planet Radio 88 FM, you're listening to A Climate Affair. I'm going to take you through to 7 o'clock. It is now 6:52 p.m. on a very humid Brisbane evening. We have had a huge show today. If you're still listening, then I'm sure you've got a head full of information like I do. But I've got time for one more story of interest, which I thought was a challenge, which I'm all about challenges and making us try to rethink our perspectives on things. And the person I want to talk about is an environmentalist who's been around for a couple of decades, Stuart Brand. And he has actually become a heretic to environmentalism, a movement he helped found, but he doesn't plan to be isolated for long. He expects that environmentalists will soon share his affection for nuclear power. They'll lose their fear of population growth and start appreciating sprawling megacities. They'll stop worrying about frankenfoods and embrace genetic engineering, so he says. He predicts that all this will happen in the next decade, which sounds rather improbable, or at least it would if anyone else had made the prediction. But when it comes to anticipating the zeitgeist, never underestimate Stuart Brand. He divides environmentalists into romantics and scientists, the two cultures he's been straddling and blending since the 1960s. If you don't know, he was with the Merry Pranksters and the Grateful Dead at their famous Trips Festival in San Francisco. He directing a multimedia show called America Needs Indians. That's somewhere in the neighbourhood of romantic. But he created the shows drawing on the cybernetic theories of Norbert Wiener, the MIT mathematician who applied principles of machines and electrical networks to social institutions. Mr. Brand imagined replacing the old technocratic hierarchies with horizontal information networks, a scientific vision that seemed quaintly abstract until the internet came along. Mr. Brand, who is now 68 and lives on a tugboat in California, has stayed ahead of the curve for so long that he is a writer, a techno guru, environmental philosopher, and supreme networker. He's almost become a cottage industry in academic circles for his breadth and impact. And last year, Fred Turner of Stanford published a book all about Stuart Brand and the sort of environmentalism that he has started. He actually begun the Whole Earth Catalogue, which is a major addition to the environmentalist movement. In addition to publishing the Whole Earth Catalogue, he organised the first Hackers Conference in 1984 and helped the Well, an early electronic community that was sort of a prototype of the web. So he was actually someone who knew everyone and brought the counterculture and the cyberculture together. He actually was involved in Wire magazine back in the 1990s, and he's now promoting environmental heresies, as he called them in a recent magazine. Stuart Brand thinks that genetic engineering is a tool for environmental protection, crops designed to grow on less land with less pesticides, new microbes that protect ecosystems against invasive species, produce new fuels, and maybe sequester carbon. He thinks the fears of genetically engineered bugs causing disasters are as overstated as the counterculture's fears of computers turning into Big Brother. Starting in the 1960s, hackers turned computers from organisational control machines into freedom machines, he told a magazine last year. And, you know, we're the green biotech hackers. He's also looking for green nuclear engineers and says he feels guilty that he and his fellow environmentalists created so much fear of nuclear power. Alternative energy and conservation are fine steps to reduce carbon emissions, he says, but now nuclear power is a proven technology, working on a scale that makes serious difference. He says there are legitimate reasons to worry about nuclear power, but now that we know about the threat of climate change, we have to put the risks in perspective. And nuclear waste is a problem, but he says the great thing is about it, you know where it is and you can guard it. The bad thing about coal waste is that you don't know where it is and you don't know what it's doing. The carbon dioxide is in everybody's atmosphere. I think that's a really good point. You know, at least we understand what are the emissions from nuclear reactors and we can deal with them. As I said a couple of weeks ago in my show, the amount of waste that a nuclear reactor produces per year is really quite small. I mean, very small. It's not vast gallons of nuclear waste. That's why the American nuclear reactors are able to store all of the nuclear waste they have ever produced on their own sites at the moment is what's happened in America, which probably isn't ideal. They should probably move them off-site to some safer storage location, but it's an indication at least of how small the nuclear waste really is. So Mr. Brand predicts that his heresies, as he calls them, will become accepted in the next decade as the scientific minority in the environmental movement persuades the romantic majority. He still considers himself a member of both factions, just as in the days of the Merry Pranksters, but he's been shifting towards the minority. His trend's been towards more rational and less romantic, he says, over many decades. He keeps seeing harm done by religious romanticism, the terrible conservation of romanticism, and the ingrained pessimism of romanticism. It builds a certain immunity to the scientific frame of mind. So that's a little bit of information about someone who has been in the environmental movement, is also active as an information theorist and a social networker, someone who's been a part of our global culture and counterculture for the last 30 years, and he's starting to revisit some of the topics that have become stalwarts of environmentalism, such as anti-nuclear power, for example. I think it's really interesting how much science needs to be a part of a holistic environmentalism. If we don't have good science to back up our feelings, then perhaps those feelings need to be readdressed and maybe we need to think carefully about them. It doesn't all have to be doom and gloom, which is exciting. Maybe he's right. If he is right and we don't have to worry about overpopulation and if we can support technologies like genetic engineering for foodstuffs, then that's an uplifting experience. I personally have a problem with genetically modified crops, not because of the technology or the science, but because of the politics and the business and the economic pressures. So my question to him is, yes, you're right that I think science is very important, but it isn't the whole story when it comes to implementation. And perhaps he's still a little bit politically naive, dare I say it, in terms of actually what goes on in order to bring technologies into reality, into our societies. Well, that's about all I've got time for today on A Climate Affair. It's been a big show. I hope everyone is reached home and they've got a nice dinner to look forward to and a nice safe space to rest and recover from the day. Only one more day till the weekend. Nevertheless, you can enjoy the week just as much as the weekend. It's just smaller segments of time. I'm Kate Conroy with you. It's Planet Radio 88 FM.